For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello.
Hey, Jim.
Hey, what's up?
What's up with you?
Oh, just sitting around the Capitol waiting for the end of the shutdown.
Jim Newell covers Washington for Slate. He joined me from a phone booth in the Senate press gallery to talk all things shutdown. We're at 33 days.
Is that I stopped counting. yeah, somewhere in the 30s, I know we are.
I mean, in the last 5 weeks, how many bills have passed in Congress trying to reopen the government?
In the House, they're voting this week on the 10th and 11th.
10th and 11th?
Yeah.
The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, she's been especially busy. Yesterday, she wrote a note to the White House postponing the State of the Union. Then her office drafted yet another budget proposal aimed at opening up the government. It offers more money for border security, but not a wall. Over in the Senate, on the other hand...
In the Senate, they are, well, most of them currently aren't even here. This week, it's been that they've been on 24-hour notice of if they're going to vote on anything. Some have been here, some have not been, but they've sort of just been waiting for the bat signal that they're going to be vote scheduled.
And today's the day.
And today is the day, finally.
Dun, 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 dun.
Only took 5 weeks.
5 weeks. That is how long the federal government has been partially shut down. 800,000 federal workers are either furloughed or working without pay. Most can't collect unemployment because technically they are employed. The report that really got me this week was in the Albuquerque Journal about a 10-year-old girl who broke her wrist sledding but hid the injury from her parents. Her father works for Homeland Security, had warned her that the government shutdown meant they didn't have money to spare. Today's the first chance Congress has to turn this mess around. The Senate's going to be voting on two different bills to reopen the government. Not many people have much hope that either are going to pass, but Jim Newell is here to explain why we should pay attention to this moment anyway. Stay with us. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Okay, so today we're seeing this first legislation that could end the shutdown moving forward in the Senate. But I want to talk about like how we got here. At the end of last week, the White House puts out this announcement that we're going to talk about some kind of compromise. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. So with talks at a total standstill around this time last week, the White House came out and said that we're going to put a plan on the table in a speech on Saturday. It was something that Jared Kushner and Mitch McConnell had been working on.
By incorporating the priorities of rank-and-file Democrats in our plan, we hope they will offer their enthusiastic support, and I think many will.
It was sort of temporary protections for DACA recipients, Dreamers, as well as beneficiaries of temporary protected status. 3-year extension of that in exchange for Trump getting his full $5.7 billion wall request. That was at least how it was framed initially.
Once Jim dug into the actual text of the bill, though, the new protections, they looked really narrow. There were restrictions on how migrants could apply for asylum. That could block thousands from entering the country. It hiked the fees for applying for DACA protections, and it would make a smaller pool of people eligible, which is all fine if you've still got control of both houses of Congress, but not if you're negotiating with House Democrats or House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, it was just a mess. It almost looked like Republicans put so many poison pills in there to ensure that it wouldn't get any Democratic votes so that they could say Democrats are being intransigent on this nice compromise we put together. I mean, that's how cynical it seemed, you know, the level of changes. It was not something designed to get, you know, 75 or 80 votes.
You know, I was really struck when the president made his speech on Saturday announcing this idea. He said he'd met with Democrats, or his team had met with Democrats and sort of made their voices part of that. Is that true?
No. I mean, he had one meeting with Democrats last week. He had a meeting with some centrist House Democrats, and their message to him was, first reopen the government, and then we can talk. So, you know, I think that was probably a very generous reading on his part of what Democrats would be willing to go for.
And Democrats, they've reacted like immediately, even if it's possible to react before immediately, I feel like they reacted, right? Even before his speech, they said they rejected it.
Yeah, Nancy Pelosi, I mean, yeah, before, when she saw what the offer was going to be, rejected it, called it a non-starter, which, by the way, did not go over well with some centrist House Democrats. They at least thought maybe she could have waited for him to give the speech and then call it a non-starter.
And so you're putting your finger on something, which is at the same time that clearly President Trump is feeling some pressure to do something, Democrats are beginning to feel that pressure, too. Like, a few Democrats wrote a letter to Nancy Pelosi, right?
Yeah, some Democrats, you know, in this new class, there are a lot of Democrats who took over districts that Republicans have held for decades that are just, you know, turning somewhat blue, but are still very swingy districts. And so Elaine Luria, who's from Virginia, a new Democratic member, she is organizing a letter and collecting signatures still, essentially asking Nancy Pelosi to hold a vote on Trump's wall after Trump reopens the government. So, you know, this isn't really that big of an ask. I don't know if Pelosi, what her thoughts are on it yet, but, you know, you could, if Trump reopened the government and then they just held a show vote where they either reject the wall request or they amend it to make it whatever Democrats want, you know, that's not really asking Pelosi to concede too much. But I do think it's important to note that some Democrats are getting a little bit restless and sort of want to get this machinery going where we're at least eliminating options so we can find what is the compromise that's going to reopen the government.
And I guess when I heard about the vote today, at first I was confused because in the early reporting was like Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer have come to a compromise. We're going to have a vote. And I was like, oh, wow, maybe people have talked to each other and like there's a compromise going on. But then it turns out the compromise is two different bills that have nothing to do with each other, right?
Yeah, it's just a procedural compromise. It's not actually a deal being cut. It is one vote first on Trump's proposal, which Democrats aren't going to go for, and then a vote on one of the bills that the House passed that would just reopen government, stopgap bill until February 8th. So the big question once that deal was announced was, okay, is this Trump and Republicans caving here? Like, are they going to support this February 8th compromise, you know, this bill that they're finally bringing up? Or are they, you know, just going to reject it too because it needs 60 votes? And it's looking a lot more like they're going to reject it too.
So you have one bill that the Democrats really don't like, one bill that the Republicans really don't like.
Well, the Republicans may like it, but Trump doesn't like it, so they can't like it, you know?
Well, says who?
I mean, says their own fear of, you know, having Trump go after them if they defy him. I expect the White House and I expect McConnell to urge most Republicans not to vote for this.
Huh. So do you expect that whatever happens on the floor of the Senate tomorrow, it's like we should pop some popcorn and settle in and like watch?
I don't think you should ever pop popcorn and watch the Senate and expect too many fireworks. But we'll have to see, you know, as the day goes on, where, say, Susan Collins is, where Cory Gardner from Colorado, who has a tough race coming up, is, where some of the other senators who are in either vulnerable or in a, you know, representing more moderate states, if they're willing to go for this. If they're also, those vulnerable ones, not going to go for this, then it has no chance. And then we will, where will we be? I don't know. We will be stuck as we've been stuck forever. So,
well, I mean, you've said like there's very little chance of either of these bills passing. So why hold the vote at all?
Well, I think Mitch McConnell, you know, I think the criticism that he's not been doing anything, has been refusing to take any votes. I think there was a little bit, I think that got to him a little bit, and he wants to put something on the floor. You know, the reason that President Trump came up with this whole proposal in the first place was Mitch McConnell reached out to him and said, we need to get something on the floor to vote, and at least, you know, look like we're acting, and that, you know, maybe that puts a little bit more focus on Pelosi, that she's not doing enough to compromise. So, I mean, that's why they were putting Trump's bill on the floor. And then, you know, Democrats says, okay, if you don't want us to jam, you know, shut the Senate down, extend this for days and days, then, you know, we'd like a vote too. So it's mostly a timing thing is why they're putting the second vote on the floor.
If both are rejected, does it kind of force people back to the table? Or do we just honestly not know because everything is so unprecedented at this point?
We honestly don't know. I mean, I do think it's important that some of the pressures that have just been sitting around are starting to show themselves. You know, it's important that McConnell was feeling a little uncomfortable in his position of not putting anything on the floor. It's important that some House Democrats are getting a little anxious with Pelosi's position that she won't negotiate. And we're starting to see a little action, and we're going to, you know, even if we see things rejected, that can be useful in finding, well, okay, this isn't going to work. This isn't going to work. This sounds very pathetic what I'm describing, you know, that this is progress. them rejecting bills is progress, but it is. I mean, considering last year it was just, you know, Trump canceling Nancy Pelosi's flights and stuff. That was like where we were. So
this feels like a level up.
It is a level up. There's actual legislative stuff happening rather than just, yeah, pranks and tricks and stuff like that.
Okay, I want to take a moment to talk about the characters here. You talked a little bit about Mitch McConnell. He holds a lot of power here as the majority leader in the Senate. You said you think he's feeling a little bit of pressure to act. But I'm just wondering, why has he been feeling not so much pressure until now? Like, is it just that he's from a state where there aren't a lot of government workers, so he's not hearing from his constituents? Why is he able to hold himself at such a remove?
The reason he is holding himself at a remove in the first place and sort of going by, you know, what Trump wants and not passing anything that Trump won't sign, he does not want to get his caucus into a divisive fight with President Trump over how to reopen the government. And because they think that Trump will then put the blame on them, to the Republican base, for caving to Democrats. So that's not something you want to deal with. The reason he may be moving now is just that the shutdown is getting longer and longer. Republicans in polls are getting the blame for it. Republicans are defending seats in Colorado, Maine, Arizona, North Carolina, Iowa next year that they need to hold their majority. You know, not all these states have a ton of government workers, and that's probably why he was allowed to hold on as long as he has already. But we may be at the point where this is going to do real political damage if, you know, it goes on much longer and, you know, Senate Republicans need to step in.
Can you put me inside of his head a little bit? I mean, you're much closer to him than I am.
Are you sure you want to go there?
I asked, so.
Well, I just think that's, you know, he just prioritizes what's the worst case scenario. And for them, most of the shutdown, the worst case scenario has been getting into a fight with Trump over the wall and caving on his behalf. You know, I don't think for a second that he thinks the shutdown was a good idea. Hmm. I think that's the way he prioritizes it. And once he chooses a path, he doesn't really veer from it. It takes a lot for him to get rattled.
It's so interesting because, you know, the Republicans for so long catered to their base and still do. But now it seems like the catering is out of fear. Like, the student has become the master. But I mean, that's just me looking from the outside, where it just seems like they're really controlled by a very consistent voting population.
Right. And I think in the Obama era, it was with the Tea Party and just the way they were very trigger happy with putting primaries on members. You know, that's the way it was controlled. And now with Trump, I mean, all that energy is manifest in him. So, you know, he's seen as the one fighting for the wall, fighting for what the base wants. So if you go against him, a lot of voters will see that as directly going against the base by going against him. It's not a very healthy environment.
I mean, so much of these negotiations rely on personal relationships. Does Mitch McConnell get along with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer?
I don't think he gets along with Nancy Pelosi, but I think he respects Nancy Pelosi and, you know, recognizes her as formidable. McConnell and Schumer, they're not like going out to dinner together, but I think they have a decent working relationship, even if you see them trashing each other on the floor. Like, I think these are all professionals here, and I think they all understand what the other is doing. So I don't think they really let their personal feelings get in the way of it too much.
Okay, so if I'm getting ready to settle in for some C-SPAN today, what am I looking for on the floor of the Senate? Like, who am I looking to sort of be lured over or peeled off? Like, what should I watch for?
One, on the first vote on Trump's bill, I'd be curious to see, one, if it got any Democratic votes, and also if it lost any Republican votes, because it really does have some things that would be upsetting to GOP moderates as well, some of the asylum changes. And then on the short-term bill to reopen the government, the House passed one, I would watch someone like Tom Tillis or Cory Gardner, just someone who, you know, is an interesting political territory in 2020, and see what they do. If Republicans get a significant number of defections on that, you know, even if it doesn't get them to 60, it's going to show sort of how deteriorating their position is and how they can't really hold out on this for too much longer.
You know, the last time we talked, it was a week or two ago, and you said you weren't really seeing like the impact of the shutdown when you were in Congress. I wonder if that's changed at all. I mean, you live in D.C. Are you beginning to see and feel the shutdown in any new ways?
I mean, you see like all these restaurants and bars, you know, specials for furloughed workers and things like that. And, you know, so my girlfriend and I were on a house search, and a couple houses we were looking at had to go back on the market because the financing fell through because of the furloughs. So, you know, yeah, it's just everywhere in D.C.
No more food banks. They need paychecks. No more food banks.
Furloughed workers gathered en masse outside of senators' offices yesterday. They hoisted up these styrofoam plates meant to symbolize that they need to feed their families. They had messages on them, like jobs, not walls. Hostage, read another. If the shutdown doesn't end today, these workers aren't going to be getting paychecks tomorrow.
I do think that's related, too, to why they're having these votes on Thursday. You know, they because the next payday is Friday and they want to have something. You know, they don't just want to let that happen.
All right. Good luck in there, Jim.
Yeah, thank you.
Jim Newell covers Congress for Slate with a smile on his face and a song in his heart. That's today's show. What Next is hosted by me, Mary Harris, and produced by Mary Wilson and Jason DeLeon. We've had a ton of help this week from Daniel Hewitt. Leave us a rating and review us in Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find us. Also, I have a little secret for you if you've made it this far. What Next has an Instagram account. We're still figuring the thing out, but go ahead and follow us there anyway. We're at What Next Pod. Talk to you Friday.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS, we are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.